Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming along tonight for our discussion on climate change and the storage of carbon dioxide. Professor Herbert E. Hubbard's here tonight. He makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. I think, Professor Hubbard, last time you were here, you spoke on the important topic of bioterrorism, and tonight on an equally important topic of carbon dioxide storage. I'll introduce our speaker briefly. Some of you here know him. Professor Hubbard was educated at the University of Sydney, born in Australia, educated at the University of Sydney. He then proceeded to do his PhD at the University of California, San Diego. From there he went to the University of Cambridge. He's a published author, of course, but currently Director, Institute of Theoretical Geophysics at Cambridge University. And Professor Hubbard's going to speak for us, as I said, on climate change and the storage of carbon dioxide. Professor Hubbard, you're very welcome. Thank you. Now, I should say, our speaker's got a slightly bad throat, but he's all wired up and ready to go. Okay.
Well, thank you very much for that introduction. As Gerald said, I have a bad throat. It came on about 3 or 4 hours ago. And this may be the shortest talk that I ever give in my life. And I'll definitely be the most embarrassed. I thank Julia Gillard for making a presentation on Sunday to advertise my talk. It was really very kind of her. And to add to the advertisement, I think Tony Abbott put a totally different view. And part of what I hope you will learn about tonight is what the background is, and you'll be able to make up your mind on some questions yourself. What I would like to do is to tell you about the background to climate change, to tell you something about geoengineering, how we might change the Earth so it behaves more like we want, tell you about carbon dioxide capture, tell you about the transport of carbon dioxide, about storage, and then we'll come to conclusions. Now, in order for me to pitch this talk better, I'd like first to divide the audience in three by a show of hands, and the show of hands will tell me whether you think that climate change is a definite effect that is causing problems, climate change might be happening, and that climate change is a pile of wank and isn't going to happen at all. So the first group, I'd just be interested to know roughly what proportion really believe that climate change is happening. I'd say about half the audience. Climate change might be happening, there might be something in it. A third of the audience, and that climate change is nothing at all. I'm glad to see that there's one member of the audience. I have a friend, the world's best geophysicist, who at meetings occasionally will say, "No, Mr. Secretary, please do not put it down, the vote, as 19 to 1. I'd like it 19-4, Mackenzie against." So, sir, you are to be voted in. Okay. Well, that helps me in my knowing how to pitch this talk. Well, to talk about climate change first, the idea was first thought about by John Tyndall, who was a very famous physicist in the 1800s, and he wondered how warm the Earth should be. So he first took off the atmosphere and he just asked if the sun comes down, and he knew how strong that was, and it radiates back. What's the equilibrium temperature? And he got minus 30 degrees centigrade for the average temperature of the Earth. He knew that was wrong, And so he knew that the atmosphere must play a part. He also knew that greenhouses work very well. He understood the principle of a greenhouse, and he assumed the atmosphere behaved like a greenhouse, with the particular gases being important in the greenhouse. So he did experiments first on nitrogen and then on oxygen, the most prevalent and second most prevalent element in the atmosphere, and was shocked when he found that there was no greenhouse effect at all. And he was about to stop the experiments when he thought, why doesn't he try carbon dioxide, water and methane that occur in the atmosphere to very, very small amounts? But he thought maybe they play a role. And much to his surprise, but definite, they play a very powerful effect. And so he understood the ideas I've sketched here, that solar radiation comes in, it hits the greenhouse gas layer, which I've lifted above the Earth. It's, of course, made up of clouds on the Earth and the atmosphere. Some of that radiation is reflected, some is transmitted. It hits the surface of the Earth, that's radiated and reflected again, and some of it is transmitted, just as in a greenhouse. And from that he could make a calculation, and he got the temperature of the Earth, on average, much closer to what it was. Then in 1960, a postdoctoral student, Dave Keeling, started measuring the carbon dioxide content in Hawaii, and he made the beginnings and then continued it, and it's now being continued by his son, these famous measurements showing that the carbon dioxide content in parts per million in the atmosphere have gone up from about 315 to 390 or so over the last 50, 60 years. They're seasonal variations as trees take up carbon dioxide, then they die and they give it back to the atmosphere. Measurements of temperature over the last 150 years, as I show you here, are very noisy. There are times for the first 80 years or so of this graph where they haven't varied much on the mean, but there's no doubt there has been a mean increase in the temperature, the global average temperature. This, in a sense, tells you nothing about the temperature in your backyard, but it does tell you something about the global average temperature. Now, how has the world changed? Because that's really an important input to this question. Over the last 100 years, the world population has increased by a factor of 4. The US population has increased by about the same amount. But the world energy usage has increased much more, by a factor of 13, and the US energy increase has been a factor of 9. The energy consumption of the world, the US, India and China, just over the last 45 years is shown here. And you see that China has increased in the last 45 years its energy consumption enormously. Now it consumes as much energy as the United States. 10 years ago, it consumed 50% as much as the United States. So it's doubled its amount in the last 10 years. Really quite remarkable. This is to a large extent due to oil, one of the three major fossil fuels, and it is a direct response, or a direct response of that is the number of cars. You see here in 1900 there were virtually no cars at all. Now in the world there are 700 million cars. In the United States there are 250 million. In this country there are 16 million cars. There are only 2.5 million in 1960. So over 50 years, there's been an increase of a factor of about 7 or so. It's interesting that there are only 8,000 in the United States in 1900. There were 144 miles of paved road throughout all of the United States, none in California, no paved roads at all. As I said, fossil fuels still account for 85% of the energy consumed, mainly coal, oil and gas. There's a little bit of nuclear and hydro and winds and things like that, but that really is very small. Some people like this photograph. It's actually in colour. Do not think it is in black and white. It is in colour of a steam locomotive in China, burning coal, taking behind it some 150 trucks of coal to be delivered. China burns an enormous amount of coal, an enormous amount of our coal also, putting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, as you in a sense see out of this funnel. Now I want to show this slide, which is the extent of the sea ice in the Arctic. This is the minimum extent in the summer, because it shows quite a number of things. First of all, that it's a very noisy record again. There are ups and downs, but you can be definite that things are changing. But if you look at special periods, you can think that it's not changing on the mean, you can think that it's increasing on the mean, or you can think, as you see here, that it's decreasing. The other reason that I showed this is because the minimum here, which is actually 2 years ago, I haven't brought this graph up to date, was considerably less than the computed minimum, the forecast minimum. So it was even worse, it was even warmer than we had anticipated. It's very important to distinguish short-term and longer-term trends, and it's the longer term that counts. Here's now, going back for the last 800,000 years, the temperature record at the top and the carbon dioxide record at the bottom, and you see how closely correlated they are. They're maxima in one when there are maxima in the other. Quite a similar shape. This is now looking over the last 1,000 years, and the point that I want to make here is that over the last 30, 50 years, the carbon dioxide concentration and the temperature have increased together and considerably, really a very large increase in carbon dioxide concentration. The effect in the temperature over Great Britain is shown here. This is the change in the average daily maximum over the last 45 years or so. And you see, first of all, it's all positive, that it's spatially variable, but that it goes up as much as 2.5 degrees. Now, 2.5 degrees might not sound much, but on an average, and I'll explain this a little more later, it really is quite considerable. There's a definite spatial variation, as you see here around the world. There, this is now December 2010, compared with the average between 1961 and 1990. And you see everything that's blue or purple on the blue side is negative. Anything on the yellow or red side is positive. So there are lots of increases, but also a few decreases. Just in December, temperatures have been a little less in Australia, for example. But the climate change is already definitely having an effect in Australia. This is an indication of the rainfall in Australia over 12 months the end of 2006 to 2007, and you see how many areas in dark red were the lowest on record. There were severe deficiencies in the places that were in sort of light red, and the very light red, even there was a severe deficiency. And we all know that drought is an important problem in Australia and a difficult problem. The sea level has also changed because the temperature is increasing. We all know that when you heat something, it expands. If the atmosphere is hotter, the sea gets hotter and the sea expands. It's on average 4 kilometres deep, and it'll expand a few centimetres, at its extreme maybe even a few metres. The slope is relatively linear, and it's something like 3 millimetres per year. Now, everything I've told you so far is past data, and you can't argue with the past data. You can argue with the interpretation, but the data is the data. I'm now going to say a little bit about predictions into the future, and there you can argue an enormous amount, and the single gentleman here definitely will argue, or if not, I'm disappointed with his stance. I don't know what's going to happen in the next 50 years. I don't know how the population is going to change. I don't know what effects they're going to be. I don't know what happens when we drive the Earth into a completely different parameter regime than we've ever known before. I can make calculations, but I don't know how correct they are, because it's a new regime. And the IPCC, which in general does its work very carefully, says that the temperature increase could be anything up to some, maybe even 10 degrees, which would be horrendous. It means much more energy in the oceans because they're hotter. That means many more hurricanes, higher sea levels, flooding, lots of real catastrophes. This is now the projected UK summer temperatures. There's no doubt again that until 2010 there has been an increase over the last 30, 40 years of the mean summer temperature. 2003 was the hottest temperature on record. There were 15,000 deaths in France over the summer of 2003, generally old people, couldn't take the heat, and some 2,000 in the United Kingdom. But it said that by the 2060s, there's quite some possibility that the lowest summer temperature will be higher than this terrible one in 2003 that killed so many people. Again, there's spatial variation. This is now a increase in the temperature around the globe that's forecast with one model some 80 to 90 years ahead. And you see that the mean global average, it's suggested, might be something like 3.5 to 4 degrees. But there are definitely variations on that figure. The effect on sea level is that many people could be exposed to flooding. The cities of Tokyo, Shanghai, Rotterdam, London could be at risk of flooding. And one thing that I don't like about this slide is it doesn't show you the Houses of Parliament underwater. This is terrible because my son is the MP for Cambridge and I don't want him underwater. Though he can swim as an Australian, he knows well how to swim. Some people suggest this might be our way of life now, going around in boats like this. Not very good. Now, there are often moves that suggest that we should save the Earth. It's not the Earth that needs saving. It's the people on the Earth that need saving. The Earth has been around for 4.5 billion years. It'll be around for another 13 billion years. And none of you will be around to check that statement, but I assure you it's correct. It's the people, and I'm not sure they will be around for so long. As I've said, fossil fuels use over 85% of the world's energy. We put out 31 gigatons per year, in other words, 31 billion tons per year. The US and China puts out 6, the United Kingdom puts out 0.6, Australia puts out 0.3. What does 0.3 mean there? It means that the carbon dioxide that is put out over Australia is 0.3 billion tonnes per year. But if you factor in the carbon dioxide that's put into the atmosphere due to the burning of coal that comes from Australia, then that adds another 1 billion tonnes a year, another 1 gigaton. It's 1.3 gigatons per year then. So just by selling coal, and I know how important that is to the finances of Australia and New South Wales in particular, you multiply by a factor of 4 the amount of carbon dioxide you put into the atmosphere. You see here Australia can be proud of the fact that it's pretty well equal with the United States in the mean per person. If it wants to take in that amount that it sells to Asia, then it beats the United States because the United States doesn't sell much coal. Now, I had a discussion over this with David Gonski the last time I was in Australia, and he was adamant that you do have to include that. I think that's questionable, but it's an interesting interpretation. Nepal puts out 0.1 ton per year, so 200 times less than Australia. That's not the lowest country, but it's the lowest country that I've been to, so I put that in. Now, what do you do about this? Well, you could change human psychology. You can get people to behave differently and consume less. Now, my wife's the professor of psychology at the University of Cambridge. She knows a lot about this sort of thing. She believes it's possible to change people's views. She believes that it's something worthwhile doing, and I agree with that, but I'm not so convinced that it's easy to do. You can change aspects of the Earth by geoengineering. You can put mirrors in space, which will reflect some of the solar radiation. You can paint roofs are white. You can paint roads are white because that reflects more energy. You can do things to clouds. In my opinion, each one of these has difficulties associated with it. And one of the big difficulties is if you try it out and it doesn't work, what do you do then? If you distribute mirrors all over space and then you find that it plunges us to minus 30 degrees centigrade and you want to get them down again, that's damn difficult. The white roads is fascinating. I once did some consultancy for an oil company, and I found out that the total area of roads in the United States is equal to the state, the area of the state of Texas. So I said, well, why don't you paint all the roads white? That would be fabulous. Now, one of the things that caused an enormous problem is titanium is one of the ingredients in paint. Only a very small amount is titanium. But the amount of titanium you'd need just to paint the United States roads white is, I can't remember the exact number, but 100 times more than we have totally available. So that's not a possibility. One very imaginative suggestion, and I say this with some sort of pride, by a colleague of mine who's from Melbourne and very intelligent, even if he's from Melbourne, I say that away from the microphone, is to put up a hose into the stratosphere going up some 20 kilometres, held up by a balloon that's some 300 metres in diameter, and it'll flare off aerosols. What a wonderful birthday present. Imagine giving somebody a balloon. I don't think that's going to work. Another possibility is to remove the carbon, either by ocean fertilization, which is taking the carbon into the oceans, but that has shown not to be very successful. Taking the carbon dioxide from the air, the problem there is there are only 400 parts per million, and it's very expensive to take it exactly from the air. Taking it from power stations and then sequestering it, storing it. How do you store it? You can store it in trees. As I've already said, trees love carbon dioxide. But it's been calculated if you wanted to store just the carbon dioxide that's emitted by the power stations in Great Britain, you'd need to cover Great Britain with a third of forests, a third of Great Britain covered with forests. Some of us think that would be nice, but the Londoners wouldn't. There's an imagined suggestion to put it at the bottom of the oceans by a friend of mine and colleague in Harvard, who's a very interesting character. But as I point out to him, the bottom of the oceans is a long way away from many sources, to which he shrugs his shoulder and says, well, we'll just move all the power states to New Jersey. That'll be easy. That's the sort of imagination he has. I always like that. We can put it into depleted oil reservoirs, into brown coal seams, and I was asked by a company in Queensland that apparently is doing very well putting carbon dioxide into brown coal seams. You can mineralize it. Now, the Earth does that all the time. It takes the carbon dioxide and it makes calcium carbonate limestone, but it takes hundreds of thousands of years to do that, and I don't think we have hundreds of thousands of years. After all, the average age in this room is, excuse me, I think 50 or 60. The Earth is 4.5 billion years old. It beats all of us. The next possibility, and the one that I believe is the most likely, is to put it into saline aquifers. Carbon capture from the atmosphere is very expensive. You can definitely get carbon from power stations. It's expensive to retrofit power stations, but you can build new ones like that. You can take the carbon dioxide by chemical means before you burn it in a power station. There are some new chemical ideas which are slightly more expensive but believed to be more efficient by burning it in oxygen rather than air. And then there's a company called Solera that believes you can store it in cement. And I don't want to go a long way down this road, but Solera got a lot of money from Rudd and the Australian government, and it's an interesting company. This is just... This is just some photographs of some capture plants. pipelines, transport. I think there might well be transport of tens, hundreds of kilometres. We know how to transport gas over that distance. I don't believe there'll be transport over thousands of kilometres, and that's important, as I'll indicate a little later. The most long-running and successful experiment has been at Sleipner, owned by the Norwegian gas company, and they take off natural gas from the Sleipner East field. They strip it of its carbon dioxide, and they put it back into the Utsira formation at about a kilometre depth. The reason for that depth is that it pressurizes it and makes it like a liquid. That liquid is less dense than the water in the formation. The formation is very much like unconsolidated sand, and it would rise as what's known as a plume and then spread across as what's known as a gravity current. This is also being done in Sala. And I said I'd do some experiments, and one of the reasons I said I'd do experiments to give you an indication of me, is I said to Anne, would it be all right if I did some experiments? After all, I'm a scientist. And she said, there's never been an experiment done before at the Sydney Institute. And I said, right, I'll do one. Now, unfortunately, we're in this strange room, and I have to do it in one place, and I'm going to do it over there. Some of you, I hope, can see it. I'm not used to such lecture theatres, and my voice will now really give out. At what time? And what are the royalties? I don't like that. I like my anyhow. Let me put some glycerine out, and you can see how carefully I'm doing this. I'm shaking. That shows you how nervous I am, and I put it out very uniformly. And what you see. It spreads, and it very quickly takes on an axisymmetric shape, in other words, like a circle. And if I may for a moment say, I made my reputation by calculating this and showing how rapidly it goes out. It's very important for lava flows and many things, including the way that carbon dioxide would flow through a porous medium. Poor because there are lots of little pore spaces in this sand. Let me do another problem, which is to push it out now, in a sense, manually with some force. Sorry, Dorian. And you see that again, it's sliding, unfortunately. It's relatively axisymmetric. It would be totally axisymmetric, but this must be on a hill. Now the interesting question is, what happens if I take this plate away? Will it go back in a nice, smooth, axisymmetric sense? Well, as Lord Florey, that famous experimentalist Australian, said, you only know when you do the experiment. Thanks, Robert. Right. It's right. If it goes down, it's very axisymmetric. If I lift it up, it's non-axisymmetric. That so-called instability costs the oil companies millions of pounds a year. If I knew how to stop that and not walk into this mirror, I could make a lot of money. Now, as I said, we put it down to depth because that compresses it and it's easier to store as a liquid. What actually happened at Sleipner was rather different to what they expected, in that instead of going right up as a plume, it hits a number of horizons and spread and then flowed through the horizons. And this leads to another set of experiments that I'd like to do, but this is in the middle. You want to know how it spreads, and I want to show you how important surface tension is. Some of you know about surface tension. When you have a drop of water that stays on a tap, it stays there due to surface tension. The water is definitely heavier than the air below it, and it doesn't fall down, but surface tension grips it. Now I want to show you a very simple experiment, but I did take this all the way, and this liquid, let me tell you, on the plane. That's why I'm interested in bioterrorism. I'm just going to dip this in here in this liquid. This liquid is only water coloured red so that it looks nice. People sometimes think it's the blood of my undergraduates, but it's not true. And what you already see is that the liquid has been drawn up in this toilet paper by surface tension. And we'll see after a long time it'll become unstable. It won't be this smooth section. But here surface tension has built something up. Let me show you another experiment. And I can't move this, and the cameraman wants it to be as far out as possible. And you all have to see, my God. What more? I'm going to add some just water here, blue water, to a porous medium. This is some ballatini, some little balls, 1 millimeter diameter. Rowan, is it going in? Yep. Well, I don't want to add too much, or there'll be a problem. Okay, you wouldn't. And it's a fabulous experiment when it works. damn it. Okay, what you'll see is, again, how if I lift these gates, the current goes through here and flows through. Teacher, I've never done this experiment in this equipment before. I had it built specially for this, but what's meant to happen was my mistake, really. I should only put it up a certain amount and then it just stays there. But now if I could make an advertisement, I gave a lecture at the Royal Society 4 weeks ago. It's on the web and this experiment worked perfectly. And I apologize. Right. The theory says that the radius should go like time to the half, and we plotted some data points and it was beautiful. The radius squared against time, you see all these different horizons fitted, and now I just got some new data and it works well for three of the horizons but not for another one. That's a pity, but there it goes. Now, what's the cost going to be? I'm really going to wind up now. The cost of storing carbon dioxide is roughly 2% of the GDP. That's only a year's growth. It will mean an extra cost of something like 20 or 100% per unit to capture and transport and storage it. But I think that's all worthwhile. It's much better than having huge heat waves, people dying prematurely. Is there enough space available? Well, this is just in the United States. You see there are space available for some 3,500 billion tons of carbon dioxide at the maximum. There's easily enough space. This now shows for the whole world how long you could pump in carbon dioxide at the current usage, and you see in the United States and Canada it's something between 250 and 1,000. For Australia it's been 100 and 750. I like the fact that I've heard that there's very little storage space over New South Wales, or under New South Wales rather, but lots of storage space under Victoria. And I've heard government officials from both states say that they're so pleased that that's the way it is. So both states must see advantages in that. I don't think there will be any difficulty transporting carbon dioxide from Sydney, let's say, to the appropriate places in Victoria. This is now where the current sequestration projects are going on. It's interesting that Otway in Victoria, run by CO2CRC, of which I'm a member and which is without a doubt the best field experiment in the world and trains many of the engineers, is doing very well, but it's storing 700,000 tons, nothing, compared to the 31 billion tons we put out. Gorgon on the west coast of Western Australia is about to go on stream. There are, of course, a number of experiments going on in America, in Canada, in Insala in Algeria, Sleipner, etc. But what's more interesting in this map is where the experiments are not going on. In other words, where there is no local knowledge being gained. Nothing in all of South America, nothing in Mexico, nothing in most of Southern Africa, nothing in the former Soviet Union, nothing in India. As I've said, there's not going to be much transport, not transport, I believe, from one nation to another. So they're behind before you even start. So if I can come to the conclusions, global warming is probably occurring with large worldwide consequences. I put the word probably there. My son objects to that, saying I should say definitely. It's not absolutely definitely, but there's a very, very high degree of probability. Nothing is in some sense definite in science. The consequences are worldwide. People are dying. There is flooding. There's Katrina. There's droughts in Australia. There's no doubt about it. I've said a little bit, and you can understand how I'm going to say fluid mechanics can help. I am, after all, experienced in fluid mechanics, though I know this is very much a political problem. I think there's hence a need for governments and industry and the people to face up to this responsibility for what is really the first truly international global problem. What goes on in China affects us. And it's quite different to other problems where, for example, the Thames was cleaned up and fish came back. That made no difference to Australia. Australia could dirty some little area and that made no difference for the rest of the world. China emitting plays a large role. And I'd like to end that there's many things that we'll all say, particularly you, by a wonderful exchange between Dave King, who was the previous chief scientific advisor to the British government, who said, Britain has to do something about the CO2 problem, although they're a rather minor contributor, because that's the only way the rest of the world will start doing something also. We have to show what to do. And Senator Kerry, unsuccessful possible president, said nothing to do with carbon dioxide capture will ever pass through the Senate unless all the other countries show the way first. We're not going to lead the way in possibly having to pay for something. And I think those two sides, and I of course agree with David King, show that even small countries like Australia can play a very important role. And I think to some extent the debate that Julia Gillard started on Sunday is a very important contribution to that role. Thank you very much.
There are a lot of people here. We don't have a roving mic and Foxtel and Austars here on Channel 648, so you'll need to keep your comment brief and to speak up, because we want to try and pick it up in the cameras and the microphones, so we're ready to go. Just for the ignorant like me, what did your experiments really prove?
This was to show you just how fluid mechanics can behave in unexpected and different ways, that it spreads out in a nice axisymmetric way and it comes back in a totally complicated way. And this plays an important role when you use water to push out oil. You'd like it to go out nice and smoothly, but unfortunately it doesn't. It so-called fingers. And so that's what that experiment showed. This showed the importance of surface tension, where in this case in toilet paper, but in it sucks up the liquid, and surface tension plays an important role. I'm sorry the other one didn't work. It would have been nice. What should have happened, and it was my fault, I got too anxious, is that when I first opened the gate, because I didn't have enough of a head, surface tension holds it there, just like the drop is held, and then I would have increased the head and the second gate, and it would have flowed through. So what that was showing, again, how important surface tension is. Now, that was just a little bit of science. I don't think it's important for Julia Gillard to know exactly how big the beads were. But
all the viewers and everyone here. Okay, so we go down the back and over there. We've got to be brief. 1, 2, 3, and then there, and then here. Yeah. We don't have a microphone.
I was in and out, but you may have answered this question. But obviously, we're at the very beginning of all of this. You've demonstrated that what we're doing now is a minuscule amount compared with what needs to be done. To what extent will economics determine this in terms of what's the cheapest or most likely way a country will invest? I mean, is it a race to the cheapest, or is it, you know, what's going to make it more possible to do it more quickly?
Well, I think, Anne, you ask a fabulous question. Economics clearly will play an important role. I think so will morality. Will people be willing to say, I'm going to put some money into solving this problem now so that my grandchildren don't have to pay much, much more, both financially and style of living? And that's going to be an interesting question. Do you put money in to help your grandchildren?
Down there.
Yes. Some of the graphs you showed was that for 1,000 years nothing seems to change. Where did you get the data?
That's the wonderful thing about geology. It has data stored in the rocks. You can get it from ice cores. You can get it from rocks. It's very easy to get data over an enormous amount of the 4.5 million years.
Question here. Speak, everyone speak up. Yes.
Simon Marks Isaacs. You talked about climate change and the effect of the sun and our heat, the heat source on the planet and the greenhouse effect. What is your view on any change that might be expected from the heat source?
From the sun. The solar energy definitely varies. We know again how it's varied, and it doesn't seem to vary anywhere near enough to cause any of the problems that we're seeing now. There are some slight variations, but it isn't the driver of what's going on.
Robert?
One of the major projects that became possible as of Sunday, through the announcement, was one, if you'll excuse, in Victoria, where they're going for geothermal quite differently from the way they're doing it in South Australia. What they want to do is keep the brown coal as a blanket so that you can go underneath to get out the energy, which will be enough to run half of Victoria. It's being run by the University of Melbourne, Rachel Webster, and they're using CO2 to put the heat down, to get the heat up again. Do you know about that experiment, and have you any views on how well it would work?
No, I don't know about that experiment. Geothermal energy is used quite effectively in a number of places. In theory, that could work. As always, it's a question of whether the numbers work out and whether there really is enough geothermal energy stored and if the throughput can be sufficient. You know, if I might just, sorry to be lengthy, but tell one story that is...
No, you're not being lengthy, you can't.
It's sometimes said that the Africans discovered the law of gravity long before Newton. How can that be? Well, if an African has a heavy parcel to carry, he or she puts it on his or her head because it's further from the centre of the earth and hence it weighs less. Totally correct physics, mathematically. Doesn't work out.
Right down the back over there, and I'm looking over here now. Yes, down the back. Yeah.
You, I think, are suggesting that we could collect a lot of carbon dioxide that's emitted and store it, and therefore it wouldn't have the impact on the environment. The levels of CO2 in the atmosphere over history has been 250-ish parts per million, around that order, and it's now already 400. If we were to stop emitting any more carbon dioxide, would we not already be facing very serious consequences, and is it not more beneficial to look at how to deal with those consequences than looking at trying to retard the emission of CO2?
That is a very good question, in particular because it allows me to say something that I might have said, which is the inertia of the system is something like 75, 80 years. So even if we stop now, it would take something like 70 years before we see what happens, let alone if we keep on doing things. So sure, you're absolutely correct. We should look at what we can do right now. And it comes back a little bit to the question that Anne answered. In order to do something, I asked rather than answered, I apologize. In order to do something, we have to start spending money now, but we may not see the advantages for some 20, 30 years, which by a politician's lifetime is quite lengthy.
Yes, it is. Again, to this side, but you don't have to speak up. You're down there. Yep.
You obviously see carbon capture and sequestration as a
major part of the answer. Does it concern you that in Australia, prior to carbon Sunday, the government had already reduced its funding in this area, and coming from carbon Sunday, this is non-issue? No money for it, nothing what's been proposed who confers to it. It's dropping off the radar.
Yes.
Talk back at the moment.
Yes. That's all I need to say. Obviously, yes.
So, right, so we're going to go here and then there. Okay. Could you go to speak up? Yep.
Don Brown here. Could you just expand a little bit on the problem of leakage of liquefied CO2 back to the surface, particularly in tectonic plate movements? And as a part of the question, how deep do you have to sequester the CO2 so that it will stay there?
Well, leakage is definitely an important point, and if you want to come on another occasion, I'll give you a real scientific lecture that could go on for 3 hours. We've done a lot of work on that, and I could show you the next slide. It's a very interesting point because it depends how the leakage takes place. Our calculations show it makes a big difference whether the leakage source is an old oil well that's a cylindrical pipe, or if it's a fracture, and that makes a big difference. And the physical properties make a large difference. But what I believe is if you know what the effect of a leakage will be due to certain fractures, then you can do something about it. You want to store the carbon dioxide at more than a kilometre. If it leaks and comes up above a kilometre, then it starts to exsolve slightly, has some gaseous phase. Now, volcanologists, geologists know about this very well because that drives volcanic eruptions. Just a little bit of gas, only 2 or 3% by volume, can drive the most explosive eruptions. So if you had leakage, and if it came up to above a kilometre, or really 850 metres, that could be a problem. And it's one of the reasons why the better sites are more than a kilometre down, so that they could leak a little bit, but not too much.
Right, so I had a question here. Yep.
I think that it's naive to expect that China and India, US, will modify their behaviour simply because countries like the UK and Britain choose to spend a lot of money on not solving the problem. Surely that money would be better spent in technology that we know that works and would reduce an enormous amount of CO2 emissions. It's had bad press recently for obvious reasons, but that's nuclear. You didn't mention that at all.
Speaking about nuclear energy.
Gee, am I given another hour?
Well, I have experiments on this.
Well, I mean, Gerald has just answered the question. As you know, the public are terrified by nuclear energy, and that's one of the problems. I agree with you that nuclear energy is a very sensible way forward. It was badly handled politically when it first came on board. Most people are scared about it, but the worry is really quite minor. I believe it should go forward. It doesn't have a good press. Your first point is a very interesting one, and I think that's a matter of opinion. Is it worthwhile doing something that you think is right because you want somebody else to follow that moral line? That's, I think, a very interesting, debatable point. And what do you need to get somebody else, to get China to say, yeah, we're developing 80 years behind the West. The West had wonderful use of its energy, but we'll curtail our use because we know that the West did wrong. It's a difficult argument.
We're spending a lot of money on it.
Okay, so we go 1, 2, 3, yeah.
Professor, does what you've said tonight mean that we are going to be able to continue to burn coal? Are you talking about real clean coal technology for coal-fired power stations that are are going to be able to continue to burn that fossil fuel and then sequester the carbon dioxide?
Oh, yeah. If you sequester it, if you capture it at source, and if you, you capture the, and use the techniques that allow power stations to be built so they capture, sure, the coal could be burned quite safely.
Yes.
As a total skeptic, I studied economics and I studied history. My favourite economist, John Maynard Keynes, said that we should study the short term because in the long term we should all be dead. Anyway, in terms of history, we've gone through ice ages, we've gone through warming periods. What difference does it make?
We haven't. That's the point I want to make. We haven't. The Earth can go through all sorts of things. There's no problem with the Earth. It's whether we can exist like that. I mean, the Earth doesn't give a damn if, for example, the ocean was a kilometre higher. We'd find it very inconvenient. And that's the problem. John Maynard Keynes, I think, would have said you should look to the future a little bit. I mean, I know something about Keynes. I'm at King's, his college. He might have said we'll all be dead, but King's, he said, was eternal. I think that the interesting difference to many of the problems that Keynes knew about, sorry, all of the problems that Keynes knew about, is that this one is global and will affect all of us. And the world has changed enormously. I mean, I know something about earthquakes in Tehran. There was an earthquake in the year 800. I bet nobody heard about it for tens of years or so. It killed 90% of the population. The population was 1,000 or so. And then there have been earthquakes every 150, 200 years. They always kill about 90%. The population of Tehran now is 10 million. It'll kill 9 million. There's no doubt about that. We'll hear about it like that. And the implications will be immediate on us economically. What does change?
There's someone over here, down the back and then up here. Yeah.
I have two questions.
They've got to be up loud and brief, okay?
How much did natural events such as the volcano we just had in Chile contribute to global warming? And the other one is, I can't understand how in a city where the cars are pumping out CO2, you're going to sequester that. You're answering the question regarding power stations, but what about the rest?
No, the volcanoes tend to have an influence, the medium-sized volcanoes that we see, of about 2 degrees, but it only lasts for 2 years, and it lowers the temperature by 2 degrees. It is true that naturally there's much more carbon dioxide put into and taken out of the atmosphere. Nature always beats mankind. But it's the difference that plays an important role. It doesn't matter that there's something like 750 gigatons per year interchanged naturally. We're making that 750 into 780, and that's what's causing the trouble.
Professor, what impact would sequestration have on Australia's artesian water supply?
If it's done well, none. That's an important question, and one that we've worked on. How far will the carbon dioxide go? And you want to see in America especially that it doesn't go that far, that it goes into the next door neighbour's property, because he's going to sue you because you're not allowed to do that. It's better not go into the drinking water, and you would arrange for sites such that the drinking water would not be contaminated or touched in any way.
So we've had a lot of questions. Have I missed anyone? Yeah, right down the back. Yes, John. Yes,
Professor. A number of scientists have been.
John, we need you to speak up a bit. Yep.
A number of climate scientists in Australia have been intimidated during this this event. You certainly indicated a moral tone in your presentation, which I appreciate. But do you have any advice for those intimidated scientists and our political leaders who might have a view on it, and any advice to those scientists who I find most impressed with about continuing their debate, continuing their contribution to this issue?
The question is, have you got any advice to intimidate a scientist?
I'm too scared to answer.
I really am tempted to say my wife could answer this question better. Her style would be that you have to be honest and say what you think and do the best you can, very much better than pretending that all is rosy and then finding that it isn't. I think that is a big problem. I quickly tell you, I got to know the chief research scientist at an oil company, and I said that I knew by various ways that the scientists were not telling him what he needed to know, but what they thought he wanted to know. And he said, yes, it's a terrible problem. I can't get them to say the truth, but they were so terrified of it. But that's wrong. What should the scientists do? Just say that they're putting forward their case as best they can on the best data they can.
Final question, just if you had to make, say, a 30-second pitch to Australians about the message that you have here tonight. I mean, what are you saying about Australia, Australian energy production as a coal miner and as a coal exporter? What's your message?
I think I'd say you already have the best but small-scale carbon dioxide sequestration project. You have another one beginning that will be really big in Gorgon. Wouldn't it be wonderful if Australia could at least set the scene by sequestering a considerable amount of the carbon dioxide that it produces? And then it would hope the world will follow. But Australia can't force other countries to do something, but they can lead the way on principle and in ideas.
Many thanks. It's great to have Professor Hubbard back at the Sydney Institute. We've had a great talk tonight, and you've taken a lot of questions, and in spite of your bad throat, you've got through the night and everyone's heard you. I'm not a scientist, and I don't have any contribution to say except it's been, I've learned a lot tonight, and I can see that people in the audience who are scientists have learned a lot tonight as well. We're very grateful you came here. You have an important message. It'll be the talk will be on our podcast tomorrow, on Channel 648 in time, and your paper will be published in the Sydney Papers online. But for tonight, well done, and we hope to have you back again in the future.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.